Mars is no longer a watery world. So how did all of those gullies form? We're digging into the mystery this week on Planetary Radio. I'm Sarah Al-Ahmed of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. The oceans of Mars dried up or froze a long time ago, but some of the more recent features on the planet's surface, like Martian gullies, suggest that they could have been formed by flowing liquid water. How is that even possible? Our guest this week, Jay Dixon, and his colleagues think that they might have an answer, and it has everything to do with the tilt of the red planet over time. Then the ever-awesome Bruce Betts will join me to talk about what's up in the night sky this week. We have to start off by congratulating the Indian Space Research Organization, or ISRO. Their newest moon mission, Chandrayaan-3, successfully launched on July 14th. Chandrayaan-3 consists of a lander and a rover that will attempt to land near the moon's south polar region on August 23rd. You may remember that the Chandrayaan-2 Vikram lander crashed in 2019, but ISRO learned a lot of lessons from that mission. They say that they've performed numerous tests to ensure that Chandrayaan-3 goes according to plan. And in other space news, data from the European Space Agency's CHEOPS mission have revealed the shiniest exoplanet ever found. Located 262 light-years from Earth, planet LTT9779b is roughly the size of Neptune and reflects 80% of its host star's light. That's more than even Venus, which skywatchers know is super shiny. Researchers believe this exoplanet may be shrouded in metallic clouds that act as a mirror on incoming starlight. And the European Space Agency's Mars Express mission marked its 20-year anniversary on June 2nd, 2023. To celebrate, the spacecraft's high-resolution stereo camera team created a new Mars mosaic. Each constituent image in the mosaic is individually color-matched using high-altitude imagery models. The result is a richer color global view of Mars than has ever been created before. You can find that image and more information about all of these stories in the July 14th edition of our weekly newsletter, The Downlink. Read it or subscribe to have it sent to your inbox for free every Friday at planetary.org/downlink. You know, one of the things I love about planetary science is that the more you explore the worlds around us, the more questions present themselves. An observation that seems simple at first can spin off into realms of complexity that you really did not see coming. Our topic today is a great example of this. The gullies of Mars seem very familiar at first glance. They appear similar to water carved channels on Earth, but as we all know, Mars is not the ocean-covered world that it used to be. Some researchers have suggested that the gullies on Mars could have been formed by frozen carbon dioxide, more popularly known as dry ice. But new research by our guest this week, Jay Dixon, and his colleagues proposes that the gullies might be caused by something way more complex. Dry ice still plays a role, but to get to the real story behind Martian gullies, we have to understand the changing obliquity or axial tilt of the planet over time. Jay is a research scientist in image processing at the California Institute of Technology. With a career spanning over two decades, Jay is a pioneer in the study of planetary surfaces and remote sensing imaging. His work has taken him to some of the most extreme corners of our planet, including the wilderness of the McMurdo Dry Valleys in Antarctica. He studies our planet and then applies what he learned to the enigmatic landscapes of the Moon and Mars. Jay manages the Caltech Geographic Information Systems Laboratory and the Bruce Murray Laboratory for Analysis and Visualization of Planetary Data. Fun fact, that's the same Bruce Murray that co-founded the Planetary Society. Jay's most recent work, which we're about to dive into, involves an exploration into the Amazonian climate of Mars, but he's also a co-investigator on the Lunar Trailblazer, a NASA mission aiming to unlock the mysteries of our moon. His team's new paper is called Gullies on Mars Could Have Formed by Melting of Water Ice During Periods of High Obliquity, and was published in the journal Science on June 29th, 2023. Hi, Jay. Thanks for joining us on Planetary Radio.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for inviting me. Glad to be here.
There are so many mysteries and so many interesting comparisons you can draw between our planet and Mars, which is kind of what brings us here today. We're trying to piece together the mystery of what formed gullies on Mars. So I guess we have to start at the beginning. What are gullies on Mars, and how are these different from, say, rivers?
Gullies on Mars, they're named that because there are features on Earth. Those of us in Southern California see them in the San Gabriel Mountains all the time. These are channels that are carved into hill slopes, so typically pretty steep slopes. On Mars, they're typically found on impact crater rims, so steep slopes, and they are sort of sinuous or winding channels that go down these slopes. They were discovered in the year 2000 when we first started getting high-resolution images of Mars. And there's been a debate in the community for now almost a quarter of a century as to what formed them. Because when you look at them, you think, if you saw them on Earth, you'd say, oh, they were carved by liquid water. No problem. But as the listeners know, Mars is extremely cold, extremely dry, and it's very hard to get liquid water on the surface today. So to answer your question, they're different from rivers because rivers are on, they sort of go across country. They go on much lower slope terrain. So these are shorter channels on steeper slopes, and they've been a real enigma for the scientific community for a quarter century.
I know there are several other types of these features that they look like they were created by water, but the only explanations we can come up with are either there's some kind of sand moving, or maybe there's some kind of sublimation of carbon dioxide ice. What is it about these gullies that suggests it must be some kind of fluid that created them and not some other kind of mechanic?
Well, sublimation of carbon dioxide gas is one of the better hypotheses for actually what is forming these features. Our paper says it's probably something else, but if you look at these gullies, they are changing today. And that's a very, very active area of research. And there have been phenomenal observations that show changes to these systems. And we're debating how big are these changes, what exactly is happening. But the timing is very consistent with carbon dioxide ice sublimating or vaporizing into a gas. And that's sort of triggering potentially dry flows that's moving material within these gullies. There are some scientists who strongly argue that that could be forming these gullies wholesale, and you don't need liquid water at all. So that is one hypothesis. It's very challenging to test because there's no process like that on Earth. So frozen carbon dioxide doesn't exist. Dry ice isn't stable on the surface of the Earth. So that's a very active area of research of this alien process of carbon dioxide. Something is causing those changes today. Our paper argues that the gullies weren't formed that way.
Mm-hmm. It's just the most recent changes that are caused by this carbon dioxide. But so that means that something else must have formed them. And this is why I had to bring you in here, because what this paper is suggesting is that liquid water helped form these gullies. But it was specifically because the tilt of Mars had changed so drastically over its history that it allowed for this liquid water. So, wow, right off the bat. But I guess we have to define some terms here. This paper says that it's because of Mars's obliquity that this happened. Can you define obliquity for everyone who's just kind of new to planetary science?
Yeah, this is if you take any introductory astronomy or planetary science class, you have visual demonstrations. So I'm going to do the best I can without visuals here. Obliquity is the tilt of the rotational axis of a planet. What that means is, so there's an imaginary pole that goes from 90 degrees north in the Arctic. So I'll talk about Earth in this instance, from the Arctic down to the South Pole, from the North Pole to South Pole. If you sort of extend that pole through the entire planet, that pole is tilted relative to the planet's orbit around the sun. So all planets have an obliquity, or anything in orbit of something else that rotates has an obliquity. The amount of tilt is really, really important. So the moon, for instance, barely has any tilt, so it doesn't change too much over the course of a year. The Earth's obliquity, that tilt of the rotational axis, is about 23.4 degrees, and that's enough to give us seasons. Now, the Earth's obliquity doesn't change by more than a degree or two over tens of thousands of years. That change can cause ice ages. So it's even that small change can have dramatic climatological effects. Mars's obliquity, we know with some assurance that it changes by 10 degrees or more over the last couple million years. So that's what prompted us to start this study. What were these gullies like at high obliquity?
How quickly does Mars change in obliquity?
The last time, so right now Mars is around 25 degrees obliquity, quite similar to the Earth's tilt right now. The last time it was at 35 degrees obliquity was about 630,000 years ago in that ballpark. So it's slow by human standards, but it's been doing that for millions of years. We know that with pretty high confidence, going back and forth between low obliquity and relatively high obliquity. So it's on the hundreds of thousands of years time scale.
If the extreme is like 35 degrees on one end, how close can it get to zero on the other end?
I don't have the charts in front of me, but I believe it goes down to about 15.
Wow.
In the last 10 million years or so. Mm-hmm. And then there are consequences to that. That's not what we study in this paper, but that's my understanding. I'd have to look up the papers, but I believe it sort of fluctuates between about 15 and 35 in the last few million years.
So as we get, you know, from 15 down to 35, how does this affect the formation of gullies?
Yeah, so that's what this paper tried to address. And we're not the first people to come up with this idea of what if gullies formed relatively long ago, like recent geologically, but like 630,000 years ago. So there was a paper in 2002 that proposed this by Francois Cotard, saying that maybe the last time Mars was at high obliquity, gullies could have formed. So that's, it's been argued for a while, but we have a lot more information now than we did back then. And what we know happens now is that when the axis tilts to 35 degrees, there is a reservoir of CO2 ice, that dry ice we were talking about, that right now is trapped in the South Pole of Mars. But at high obliquity, at 35 degrees obliquity, that gets sublimated or turns into vapor and goes into the atmosphere. So the calculations show that that should double the atmospheric pressure of Mars. So the atmosphere of Mars right now is really, really, really thin, and this would make it really, really thin. So it's not going to make it a really dense atmosphere, but it doubles it. And what that does is that when you double the density of the atmosphere, that increases the pressure at the surface. And pressure is one of the key ingredients that you need to melt ice on the surface. So to melt ice on the surface, you need three things. I'm oversimplifying this, but you need three things. You need ice on the surface in the first place. So we had to show that that's there. Then you need temperatures above the freezing point for pure ice. The melting point for pure ice. And then the third thing you need is enough atmospheric pressure. Otherwise, it would just vaporize into the air like CO2 does. So our study was sort of a detailed investigation of how does the pressure at the surface change at these gully locations. And it made predictions that we were able to see correlations with for gullies on Mars.
There seemed to be quite a bit of difference in how much tilt was required for the northern hemisphere to form gullies versus the southern hemisphere. Why is there such a big difference there?
Yeah, so I think a lot of your listeners to the show will know that Mars is kind of like two different planets in one. In the northern hemisphere, where there's hypothesized to have been an ocean, it's very low topographically. So that's where you would get an ocean, is in the lowlands. The southern hemisphere is at a higher elevation. And the way atmospheres work is that the lower your elevation, the more air you have above you, so the higher the pressure. So if you're in the northern hemisphere of Mars, you're at a low elevation, so you have more air above you, so you have higher pressure. And the higher pressure means the higher likelihood that you could potentially get liquid water on the surface, that it would transition to a liquid instead of a gas. So you could theoretically have melting conditions on the surface of Mars today in the northern hemisphere. The problem is that it's hard to get ice to stay on the surface. So the ice would sublimate first before you reach the melting point. So we don't expect melting today because we only have two of the three components that you need. In the southern hemisphere, which is really the focus of our study, you're at a higher elevation, so it's harder to get those high pressures that are the minimum required for melting of ice at the surface. But at high obliquity, with this increased pressure, you do get above that pressure barrier. We call it the triple point where liquid water could form. You are able to achieve that at exactly the same elevation that gullies have been mapped on the surface. And that's the key correlation, is that the pressure increases just enough at these locations that you would predict potential melting. You need some other things to go right, but get potential melting, but not get melting at higher elevations. And that's 100% consistent with where gullies are mapped. So that's our argument, is that This explains why you have gullies up to a certain elevation, but not higher. And that is explained by liquid water at high obliquity, not today, but at high obliquity. So that's the main correlation that we try to talk about in the paper.
Are there any other mysteries that this could solve for us on Mars? Like, we're just kind of thinking about gullies here, but what else could be impacted by this obliquity?
The big one is the history of ice on the surface, and that actually has pragmatic implications. If we do want to send humans to Mars, it would be nice if we had big reservoirs of ice waiting for them. So we think that the models have predicted that at these higher obliquity periods, you should be accumulating ice close to the tropics of Mars, which we're going to have to send astronauts to somewhere where the sun is shining. So warmer areas of Mars. And if there's ice below the surface that was accumulated there during these high obliquity eras, then that's fantastic. So there's actual sort of boots on the ground pragmatism at work here. There are some other features, other sort of sinuous channels on much lower slopes that appear to date to this Amazonian period. They're small, they're fairly small, they're localized, but we see them in different places. They could be explained by higher obliquity, but that's not entirely clear. So there are some other smaller areas that could have seen small amounts of liquid water that the obliquity changes could explain, but that's work to be done.
This is cool because, you know, we've found evidence with previous rovers that there is, in fact, ice under the surface of Mars in places that we didn't really expect when we first went there. So this could solve a lot of interesting questions, at least for me, and I'm sure for other planetary scientists.
One of my favorite anecdotes is that the Viking 2 lander landed in, not in the Martian Arctic, but at fairly high latitude, and it saw frost on the surface. But 35, 40 years later, we discovered that there was very likely ice right beneath the surface. It just didn't have the instrumentation to detect it. But we see from orbit at these locations that there was very likely ice not far beneath the Viking 2 rover that's still sitting there.
Well, hopefully we continue to learn more about these gullies. And I tell you, I didn't even know Mars could tilt that far before I read your paper. That blew my mind. So today I learned.
Fantastic. Yeah, a lot of people have spent a lot of years trying to figure that out. But the evidence is all over Mars that this has actually happened. It's incredible.
Well, thanks for joining me, Jay.
Thank you, sir.
You can listen to the extended version of my interview with Jay Dixon in the podcast and online version of this show at planetary.org/radio or anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts. We'll be right back for What's Up after this short break.
Hello, I'm George Takei, and as you know, I'm very proud of my association with Star Trek. Star Trek was a show that looked to the future with optimism, boldly going where no one had gone before. I want you to know about a very special organization called the Planetary Society. They are working to make the future that Star Trek represents a reality. Boldly go to build our future.
Ready to level up your space game? Hi, I'm Amber, Digital Community Manager for the Planetary Society, and we are launching our brand new digital member community. This is a place that's built exclusively for Planetary Society members. Here you can connect with fellow members from around the world, join live events you won't get anywhere else, and delve deeper into the wonders of our cosmos and the missions that explore them. It's all about putting the Society in the Planetary Society. I'll see you on the digital frontier.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. And now it's time for What's Up with Bruce Betts, the Chief Scientist of the Planetary Society. Hey, Bruce.
Hey, Sarah.
How's your week been?
Frazzly. How about yours?
Frazzly, también.
I'm not going to try. I made up the word in English. I probably shouldn't make it up in Spanish, too. Okay, should we talk? You know, speaking of frazzly, the sky, the planets, they're moving. And they're making some big moves right around now. So we've been hanging with Venus for many months now in the evening sky over in the west. Well, sad news, Venus dropping below the horizon in the next 2 to 3 weeks. So watch it getting lower and lower. You can still see it over in the west after sunset, looking super bright. Same deal, Mars has been crossing the sky, although it's quite dim right now for Mars, but it will be gone away in a few weeks. It's up above Venus in the evening west. On the 20th, the crescent moon is near Mars. But you can watch them go away. But wait, I've ordered some replacements for those of you who look in the evening sky. And by the way, Venus will be back someday soon. It'll be back. I promise. It always comes back. But in the evening sky, we're getting Saturn's moving over to the evening. Not quite evening yet. It's rising in the middle of the night, but late evening over in the east, looking yellowish. And Jupiter coming up a couple hours later, and both are high up in the pre-dawn. Jupiter always looking quite bright. And so those will have to satisfy you. But you can still check last minute, last time by now, Venus and Mars. Don't miss it.
It's funny, a few weeks ago, we were talking about Mars being in the sky and about that really detailed Mars image that you brought up, where you zoom in really far and you could just see all the details on Mars.
This was from Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, I think.
Exactly.
And they put out a gazillion pixel. Okay, not a gazillion pixels, but they did. They sewed a lot of stuff together.
It might as well have been a gazillion pixels.
Yes, it's cool. Now, tell me a story.
Well, yeah, the story is that the person I interviewed on the show this week, Jay Dixon, was actually one of the leads on that project. I didn't do that on purpose, but that is so cool.
That is. Mars is neat. Did you know that?
It really is. I feel like I've been diving into Mars stuff for the last few weeks. And no matter how much I learn about it, I learn that there's just so much I don't know.
People studying it still know there's a lot they don't know, but they're working on it.
They're working on it.
All right, we move on to this week in space history. It was the first time humans walked on another world. So Apollo 11, this week in 1969. And on to random space facts. So Mercury, if you hang out on the surface of Mercury, which is not recommended, but if you did and you were watching the sky, you would eventually see the sun appear to move in the opposite direction that it usually moves for a few days, a few Earth days, and then it would head back the other direction. And you can even imagine being on the surface of Mercury in a period where you would see the sun rise, it would go back down and then rise a second time. This is because Mercury, having the most elliptical orbit of the planets by quite a bit, actually its speed increases near perihelion, and it actually ends up changing which is faster compared to the orbital angular speed, the rotational angular speed. So that's kind of a groovy, weird thing to look for next time you are on Mercury, the day sign of Mercury at that particular time. So have fun. Go for it, Sarah.
I did not know that. But, you know, extra funny because everyone's all worried about when Mercury goes into retrograde. But what happens when the sun goes into retrograde? You're in danger.
Man, Mercurians freak out. We try to convince them there's nothing to it. But, you know, they're a superstitious lot, those Mercurians. All right. Shall we move on to the trivia contest?
Yes.
All right. I asked you, who is the oldest person, or who is and was at the time and still is the oldest person to have flown in space? Suborbital flights count as long as they get above the von Karman line of 100 kilometers. How'd we do? Sarah.
Everyone got this one. And, you know, they have to get this one right because the answer is William Shatner, our beloved captain of the original Star Trek Enterprise. But I remember watching this when it happened and just this guy had the most intense reaction to going to space that I've seen upon returning. A lot of people say some beautiful stuff when they come back, but William Shatner was shook.
Yeah. No, it's impressive. And just to be clear, this was not just his flights on the Enterprise. This was a flight on Blue Origin, a suborbital flight. October 2021.
Yeah, he was 90 years old. Can you imagine living a whole life on Earth, acting in this role that meant so much to so many people that love space, only to get to finally go to space at age 90. That's beautiful. I hope that's true of us. I would love to go to space. But our winner this week is regular listener Norman Kassoon. Finally get to give a prize to Norman. I know you've been writing in every week, so you're going to get a special grab bag of space prizes, including one of the last rubber asteroids. So I'm really excited to give that away.
Dun, dun, dun. Congratulations!
That was a really sinister congratulations.
Congratulations. How was that?
That's better.
It's better. Yeah. Okay. I just need a little coaching.
But, you know, we got a lot of really great comments about Shatner and his experience. And Norman actually mentioned that Shatner wrote about this in his book about the experience going to space. And I remember he said this when he came down to the ground. He said, "When I looked in the opposite direction into space, there was no mystery, no majestic awe to behold. All I saw was death," which is one of the most intense descriptions of the overview effect I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, he took a different twist on it.
Yeah,
I think that's more the flying in space part of the overview effect. Maybe not.
Right. The other side of the coin. One side is Earth is beautiful and should be protected. And the other side is, oh, no.
Don't go there. It's death.
But this was really cool. We had someone write in, Henry Sanford Crane from Elkton, Maryland, USA, who said, "I've been a Planetary Society member on and off since the 80s, and the Society has kept my interest in astrophysics alive all this time. And 45 years later, I'm now working on a PhD in astrophysics."
Wow, that is very cool.
That is so cool. I love it. I had so many friends when I was going to school that said a very similar thing. Like, they had loved space for a long time and finally decided to go and pursue either their first degree in astrophysics or getting a PhD at a later point in their lives. And I was so proud of all of them and anybody really who goes through the effort to get a degree in astrophysics. It's intense, but beautiful. And of course, you know, we don't have a new space trivia contest question this week because next week is our last day announcing our space trivia winner. So we've already kind of selected, but I cannot wait to read you some of these comments that people wrote us in for the last trivia contest question, because it was about your PhD thesis and you thought maybe people wouldn't find it, but they found it, Bruce. They found it and they read it.
Oh my gosh.
No, really though.
Oh no. How insulting were they?
No, we should talk
before we record the next show.
No, it's all great stuff. And it was really wonderful. And I love that people are bringing up the member community and so many of the messages that they're sending us. I know it's like a big change to move our space trivia contest into our member community, but I think it's going to be a lot of fun in there. And I want to reassure people all over again, please send us your messages. We want to continue reading your cool poetry and all your thoughts about random space facts and anything else we talk about on the show. So please go ahead. You can continue to write us at our email, which is planetaryradio@planetary.org.
Dancing with my shadow and let my shadow lead.
That was the tricky bit. People tried to look up that lyric and the band you mentioned, and that did not get them to the right place. They literally had to find your paper.
Shockingly, Warrant didn't link to my thesis or the paper I wrote that relates to that.
We'll get into the comments.
Song, but yeah. I'm scared and excited all at the same time. All right. Everybody go out there, look up the night sky and think about dancing with your shadow and letting your shadow lead. Thank you.
We've reached the end of this week's episode of Planetary Radio, but we'll be back next week to share why the discovery of phosphorus on Saturn's moon Enceladus might make it an even better place to search for life off of Earth. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by our wonderful members. Mark Hilverta and Ray Paletta are our associate producers. Andrew Lucas is our audio editor. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. And until next week, Ad Astra.